Hello and welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colin Quinn. Now this week, you're continuing with me as we take a deeper look at ISIS. If you're just joining us and missed last week's episode, it's right there below this one. But don't feel like you've got to play catch up as we're covering some different ground than last week when we looked at the intelligence challenge. On this episode, we're going to look at the Islamic State as a financial entity. Since it came to prominence in the region, ISIS has been unique among terror organizations in that it actually holds significant territory, as well as the resources within. That's meant that as well as generating revenue from ransoms and plunder, it's also been able to become a mini petrostate, with Syria's oil fields in the east providing millions of dollars a month to fund the ISIS cause. And if the Syrian war couldn't get more complex, and this week's shoot down of a Russian jet by Turkey is a good example of that, another layer to add is that because of how bad things have gotten in Syria, enemies of the Islamic State are in fact its customers too, as the Islamic State's monopoly on energy means that both Bashar al-Assad and the forces trying to oppose him are both stuck buying oil from the very group they're fighting against. So in the face of the Islamic State's economic clout, how do you fight back? And beyond bombs, what can you do to derail the Islamic State financially and cut off its funding stream? To find out more, I spoke to Juan Zarate, a senior advisor at CSIS, and the man who is in charge of tracking down the finances of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and others post 9/11, while at the United States Treasury and the White House. We begin by talking about what goes into the ISIS economy.
One of the reasons you do have the persistence of ISIS and a growing reach, at least a sense of it, is the fact that they have resources. They've developed a war economy with a diversified portfolio of income. And what they've done is they've adapted over time to the environment, to the pressure put on them, frankly, learned the lessons of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and developed an economy that allows them to use various sources to fill their coffers. And so they've perfected the art of oil smuggling and oil refinery work. They have an entire oil infrastructure where they use the oil field as well as the refining capability in places like northeastern Syria and parts of northern and western Iraq to gain income, and they deal with brokers and truckers and the rest. And so they have an entire economy built around their control of oil infrastructure. But it's not just that. They have decided that they're going to use the antiquities trade as a source of financing. What they once taxed, they now actually run in terms of dealing in stolen antiquities. They have their own division that actually drives that part of the economy for them. They engage in kidnap for ransom. We've seen the horrific dimensions of that, but there's an actual economy and industry around kidnap for ransom. And then they extort and they tax. And we've seen that in places like Mosul, where they can actually increase the taxes as they need more revenue to be able to pay their fighters and to pay for governance and to pay for materiel. And so this is a group that has figured out how to use the resources at hand, its control of oil, food, electricity, its ability to develop new markets like the antiquities trade to actually raise hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's why experts call them the best funded terrorist group in the 21st century.
You know, these people are selling. You know, they're selling oil, they're selling antiquities. Surely there's got to be a buyer there. Is there a way of tracking these kind of purchases and shutting them down, shutting off that revenue stream?
Absolutely. To a certain extent, you've got to look at this as sort of a closed economy. And so to a certain extent, we've got to figure out ways of dislodging them and the internal workings of their economy. And you've seen a bit of the coalition efforts to do that, to cut off supplies, to hit oil infrastructure, to hit some of the mobile refineries. So that's part of the game plan. But you're right in asking the question, where does that economy then link with the regional economy or even the global economy? And that is a more difficult question because we know that in smuggling oil, they've used some of the traditional smuggling routes that Saddam Hussein himself used to use in the oil for food program, the OFF program as it's called. We know that they engage with brokers in Turkey as well as in Kurdish parts of Iraq as well as Syria. We know that they deal with the Syrian regime in Damascus. They've had a modus vivendi with the Assad regime over time to sell oil, to allow for electricity to be generated and to be sold and transferred into regime-controlled territory. And so this is an economy that does have links with the neighboring regions and countries. What we haven't yet done is mapped out what are those choke points. And if you can figure out what those choke points are, you can then begin to restrict their ability to access beyond their borders. And so to constrict the economy of the Islamic State, it's really a dual strategy. You have to dislodge them from the resources and territory that they control on the ground, but you also have to disrupt the flows and connectivity they have to regional and global networks, both of which take a lot of homework, a lot of intelligence, and frankly, a more accelerated strategy than what we currently have.
And I mean, a lot of the work against the Islamic State right now has been military and has been bombing campaigns, essentially, a lot of air power and helping some units on the ground as they can. Is there an argument for more of a financial end to attacking ISIS?
No, absolutely. And I think early on when we started to realize as sort of Western countries that the Islamic State was not going away, that its reach was well beyond Syria and Iraq, there was a tendency to think that perhaps there was some way of constricting their resources aggressively and directly that would impact their ability to expand and adapt. And a lot of folks have thought that there's some sort of magic button you can push in Washington or New York or London to be able to constrict ISIS funding. And the reality and the realization now is that you really do need a strategy that dislodges them from their resources on their ground, in addition to everything that can be done to constrict their ability to access brokers, money service businesses, even banks. And so that's critically important. One key question, Colm, for us to consider, and that is bedeviling the strategy against the Islamic State and its resources, is the fact that because it controls major urban environments, major territory, it's not controlling safe havens in the hinterlands of some mountaintop or in the jungles or deserts of some random part of the world. These are major metropolitan areas, the second largest city in Iraq, in Mosul. They actually control territory that has banks, that has economic resources. And so an interesting question is, how do you constrict the economy of an organization that actually controls huge urban environments in a way that doesn't damage the citizens and the civilians and the innocents that live there, while at the same time constricts the ability of the ISIS folks to use those resources? And this is a big question. How do you deal with the 60-plus banks that actually operate in the territory in Iraq that ISIS controls? Do you bomb them? Do you block all the transactions? Do you stop any flows of funds? What do you do about the payroll going into those who are employed by the Iraqi government who live in Mosul? Do you stop paying them totally? And so there are very real questions about how aggressively you can disrupt an organization and its economy when it actually controls elements of the legitimate economy and of these urban environments. That's a really tricky question and one that we're still grappling with as this threat unfolds.
Does the West or other outside powers even have the power to, say, stop a bank from holding ISIS funds or people who work for, who de facto work for, might be an engineer with the energy company, but he's providing energy to the Islamic State? Is there any way of outside actors exerting pressure on those banks, or is it all so self-contained?
No, there are ways, and banks are a good example of where the Western world, and the U.S. in particular, has the ability to reach in particular, to territories that aren't under its physical control. For the most part, when you talk about Iraqi banks, their connectivity to the outside world is largely dictated by Baghdad and what flows in and out of Baghdad, as well as any correspondent or other banking relationships or financial relationships that those banks may have with banks outside of Iraq. And so it's a very interesting question as to what do you do about those banks? Do you say, look, you cannot do business with any of those banks in any way? Do you hermetically seal them in some ways from the international financial community? That, I think, has been a common strategy of ours to engage in aggressive financial exclusion. But the question is that the right answer for banks that may be servicing populations that need the banks, economies that need the banks to function? And do you inadvertently do collateral damage to the Iraqi economy at a time when the Iraqi economy needs as much support and buttressing as possible? And so it's an interesting question because I don't think anyone has figured out what's the right balance here, because we could say, look, you cannot do business with any of those 60 banks. Baghdad could order a shutdown of any transmissions and flows to and from those banks. In some ways, they would wither away, or they may operate in a very local environment. But you could isolate them from the broader global community. And that, I think, is a very interesting question still to be answered by the U.S. Treasury and others.
And Juan, let's talk a little bit more about your experience in government post 9/11. You went after al-Qaeda and other related terrorist groups, attacking their financial power. What's changed since then, and what have you learned, and what have we learned since then that can be implemented against the Islamic State?
Thanks, Colm. I think three things have changed fundamentally. One, the nature of these groups, not just the Islamic State, but the al-Qaeda affiliates has changed. And they've developed and adapted in ways that have allowed them to use their local environments to their advantage. So we've talked about how the Islamic State has developed a war economy, a diversified portfolio. The al-Qaeda affiliates have figured out how to raise money on their own. Al-Shabaab, for example, has used the charcoal trade, taxes, the ports that they've controlled in the past to their economic benefit. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has made an industry of kidnap for ransom. And so if you look at the various affiliates, they've figured out ways of, in essence, living off of the local economy and developing their own economies. That's because the al-Qaeda of old was an outside-in model where there was a hierarchy funding from the outside, deep pocket donors, charities, front companies, all of which supported the global network. Now you have a much more franchised, balkanized way that these groups have operated and raised funds. And so the model has shifted. So that's one difference. The second is they've adapted to the external pressure. And so they know that it's very hard to use major banks or formal financial institutions to raise or move money around the world. And so there's just much more vigilance and much more understanding. And so these groups have used alternate economies, alternate ways of using tools. And third, the playbook that we've typically used, the idea of financial exclusion as a way of isolating rogue actors and rogue capital, hasn't yet fully adapted to the realities of these local forms of fundraising, whether it's in the form of criminality, organized crime, local economies, the use of local resources. We haven't yet figured out what is that aggressive strategy of financial exclusion that applies to this new form of terrorist funding.
There was news out this week. It was a story that had come out maybe in March, but it resurfaced again. It's the concept of data coming out of this fight against the Islamic State, that perhaps some of the combat data not had been falsified, but it's certainly not been as truthful as it could have been. Taking that same lens to the economic angle of ISIS, do we know how big they are? Do we know how everything is going? And how do we know that we're winning?
It's a great question, and I think data is and intelligence is the long pole in the tent in not only understanding what the threat looks like, not only understanding the ISIS economy, but as you rightly point out, whether or not what we're doing is actually impacting. The trouble with the current situation is we don't have enough data. We certainly don't know enough about the details of the Islamic State economy. This is why when U.S. Special Forces went into Syria to capture Abu Sayyaf, it was such an important operation, in part because he was part of the ringleader of the hostage-taking of Westerners, but he was also an important financial facilitator and node. And so the information from that raid is important because it helped us understand better what was happening in terms of the financial networks. But we don't have enough of that. We don't know enough about the brokers, the intermediaries, the key emirs who are running parts of their financial empire. And so we don't know enough. And we also don't know enough about how well they're able to adapt. And so we talk about disrupting the oil infrastructure, and that's happening to a certain extent. Some of the oil fields are being taken back. Some of their supply lines are being hit from the airstrikes. But we also know that they're able to tax at a higher rate when they're not taking in greater income. So they're taxing the shops, for example, in Mosul at a higher rate because the revenue from oil is down. And so we don't know enough about how nimble they are and able they are to shift their economy and, frankly, how much they're actually spending in terms of governance. We have an idea per fighter, but we also know that they're asking the fighters to come in with some money. They're asking their fighters to perhaps sell their passports for living expenses, et cetera. So this is an adaptive group that has felt the pressure from the West, from Iraq, from the U.S. forces over time. They've learned the lessons of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had been engaged in bank robberies and oil smuggling when we were looking at them, when I was both at the Treasury and the White House. And so this is a group that's been quite adaptive. And the reality is that we dismantled the Iraq Threat Finance Cell back in 2011, which was built to look at the financial infrastructure of al-Qaeda and the insurgency. And in essence, we're going to have to rebuild that capability if we hope to be able to disrupt the finances of this group.
You know, when you're looking, when that cell was being built, like what were you looking for in al-Qaeda's accounts? How do you even build that?
What you have to do when you're looking at the financial infrastructure or the economy of a group like this is you have to understand the details. You have to understand who are the money men. You have to understand what are their sources of wealth. You have to understand who are the key brokers. You have to understand how they're influencing the elements of the licit economy as well as taking advantage of the illicit or the black market economy. And that means you've got to get access to information from actual individuals who are part of the group, from their financial records. These groups keep meticulous records. Their ledgers tell quite a bit. Their files on their computers often explain a lot of what they're doing. And keep in mind, groups like al-Qaeda were, just like the Islamic State now, sticklers on their budgeting. And so requiring requests for budget to be documented and to have receipts attached. And so all of that is a wealth of information about what is the organization doing? How is it paying for its operations? Who is involved? And frankly, that takes a lot of spade work. That means you have to get information on the ground. You've got to analyze it. You've got to put it together with other pieces of data. And that then gives you a picture of what the organization looks like and what their weaknesses and vulnerabilities are. That then allows you to have a much more targeted strategy internally and externally to disrupt. And frankly, that's what I think we did rather well against al-Qaeda in Iraq, where we got a very good picture as to what they were doing. And we began to disrupt what they were doing internally and externally. And frankly, it weakened them to the point of being, you know, kind of a shell of its former self until we withdrew in 2011 and they began their resurgence and used Syria and the sectarianism in Iraq to rebuild their networks and their economy.
And that was Juan Zarate bringing us to the end of this week's episode. We'll, of course, be back with more next week. And if you've liked what you've been hearing on this or any other episode, or even if you haven't, let me know on Twitter or by leaving a review. To those in the States, happy Thanksgiving. And to everyone else, thanks for listening.